If I had to describe St. George in one word, that word would be steadfast.
Triumphant.
Young.
Victorious.
It would be warrior.
During the past 30 years or so, I've executed, I guess is the word, an uncounted number of images, icons. And the very first one that I attempted to depict, it was an icon of St. George. I spent literally dozens and dozens of hours making a pencil sketch of St. George, which I still have. And interestingly enough, it never proceeded to the next stage. I think that what stalled me, really, and what kept me from doing it was a feeling of real inadequacy. I never felt that the drawing was equal to the story.
When I think of St. George, it's kind of amazing because I've been able to go to his tomb in Palestine, in the town of Lida, and his tomb is very short. And when I think of St. George as a great saint, I've always pictured somebody who was kind of tall, and that's the way that we kind of have this idea of the stature of the saints. I don't know, they either had to cram him in there or he was not that tall a man, but he was tall in other ways.
When in my mind comes the image of St. George, the victorious, as is his full title, what it comes to me is the etymology of the word Georgios, Georgos, the tiller, the one who cultivates. So he prepares the soul of the Christian so the seed, which is the word of God, may be planted and come to fruition.
St. George was born about 280, and as a young man, he became an officer in the imperial army of Diocletian. His lineage is of noble birth. His parents were also quite wealthy. And so it was not at all unusual for a young noble man, robust, strong man, to enter into military service. That was, if anything, the norm. And so St. George did that. And he served Diocletian very, very well, so much so that Diocletian then elevated him and made him a member of the Imperial Guard.
One person that he even served with, St. Constantine, who later became the person who freed Christianity, traveled with George as a soldier. And George was a tribune, and the tribunes were extremely powerful. They were like the sergeants. He controlled a lot of men under him, and he rose in the ranks. And at 20 years old, he received honors from the higher authorities that very few had received up to that time.
While he was a young man and a soldier serving the army, he was stationed in Libya, North Africa. And in a town nearby there was a dragon. Now, some of the sources say that it was a dragon-like creature, like a crocodile with wings. Others say that it was just a terrifying and monstrous crocodile. Whatever, this beast was terrorizing this one town. And so what happened was the townspeople then were being devoured slowly but surely by this creature, then retreated into the fortified area of the town.
And it was a town not very small, about 15,000 people, that had to go within guarded walls because all the major cities, or even smaller cities of the time, because of barbaric invasions, would build great walls around the city and would barricade only one entrance sometimes to the city, or two entrances, so as to keep barbarians from being able to attack and to conquer the city. They locked themselves behind this wall with only what they possessed inside the wall.
Evidently, this creature had such a powerful stench from its mouth that anyone, even inside the fortified town, that would be nearby, if the dragon opened his mouth and breathed forth, would die from the foul stench that emanated from his mouth. So what the townspeople did was, each day they would have two sheep tied up far away from the fortified area of the town that would satisfy the creature.
And finally they had run out of livestock, and one by one they cast lots to see whose child would be given to this fierce animal, this beast that had terrorized them, this proverbial evil that was challenging them at that time.
And one day it fell upon the king's daughter, and sure enough, she was taken outside the city's walls, tied up, and she was waiting to be devoured by the dragon.
And the king's daughter was taken out in a royal white garb, history tells us, probably wedding garb, because of the agony and the horror of the king having to sacrifice his own daughter, the princess. He wanted her to look like a princess to be wed to death. Instead, she was to be wed to Jesus Christ, even though she didn't die in the incident, because the great martyr and the great warrior George, upon hearing of the plight of this town and being in the area, rode with his battalion into the area and took on the dragon alone.
At this point, St. George arrives on the scene and frees the maiden and does combat with this dragon and seriously wounds the dragon, so the dragon is no longer able to fight St. George. And then at that point, St. George ties up the dragon, binds it up, and drags it back into the fortified city.
And when they asked him how he accomplished this feat that none of them could have accomplished, he gave all the glory and he gave all the power to Jesus Christ. They asked him, who was this Jesus?
And before he kills the dragon, he tells the townspeople that if they convert to Christianity, that he will slay the dragon for them. And of course, they agreed to do that. After seeing what no one else could do being done by St. George, they agreed to accept Christ, and he slays the dragon. Rome began to experience one struggle, one war, one battle, one invasion after another. And so one emperor after another devised ways of trying to put down all these battles, all these problems that were really ripping the Roman Empire apart. And it was not unusual for back then, again like today, for a ruler to find a scapegoat. And for Diocletian, the scapegoats were the Christians.
Christianity was an illegal phenomenon because the Christians, in being faithful to God, would refuse to worship the emperor. And part of the pagan religion was emperor worship. Most of the emperors, of course, were very offended by that and were determined to try to wipe out Christianity.
Diocletian was an insidious emperor who, knowing that Christianity was on the rise, felt that he had been appointed and anointed by the gods, by the pagan gods, to take away this evil and to cleanse the earth from Christianity once and forever. He had this incredible zeal to be the one to be remembered. And he, to understand that one of his own, one of his generals, one of his most important soldiers was the one converting hundreds of people, made him make the ultimate error and mistake, and that was to destroy them instead of to listen to them. And at one of the emperor's incredible festivals and incredible gatherings, of which they dedicated to the gods, there were great sacrifices made of animals, and there were feasts, and there was anything you have seen in any bad Cecil B. DeMille movie or other that has the tremendously self-indulgent Romans of that period was taking place.
St. George sees a number of people in the city of Nicomedia around some doors. He goes up there, the temple doors, and sees a proclamation by Diocletian that all Christian churches are to be immediately closed, that all sacred writings of Christians, the scriptures, are to be burned and destroyed, that any Christian of notable rank is to lose that rank. and to lose all civil rights. Ordinary Christians, ordinary citizens, are to be enslaved. St. George, seeing this, rips the proclamation off the doors and just tears them apart. Well, shortly thereafter, he was sent before the Emperor Diocletian, who asked him what was the meaning of this outrageous act that he did. And he proclaims, St. George proclaims to the Emperor Diocletian all there that he is a Christian.
It was really a standoff between George and the Emperor. However, many witnessed this, and in questioning George in later encounters, they understood Christianity as a more living faith than something just to be feared, because the Romans were trying to teach the populace that Christianity was something to be feared, and George was showing that Christianity was something to be appreciated and embraced.
And we're talking now always about peer pressure nowadays. Peer pressure doesn't exist only between or among teenagers. There was peer pressure at his time as well, when he was called to kill Christians. However, he was a man with authority, and it was between two authorities. Which one shall he obey? Because he was a commander. That means he was a lieutenant, maybe nowadays. At the same time, he was a Christian. When the general gave him the command to kill, he was between the two authorities, the authority under Jesus, the authority under his commander, and he had to make a choice. So he had peer pressure as well.
After this bold move that St. George made in front of the emperor by destroying this proclamation against the Christians, of course, the emperor was not pleased, and George was imprisoned immediately. The emperor, considering the strength of this tribune in his army, this general, this soldier, this leader, began to conceive of ways to break this person down. And in his creative genius, he decided to go to the most sensitive issues that a 20-year-old had to deal with.
He had a beautiful woman there in prison with St. George to seduce St. George physically so that he would sin.
And you can imagine George upon the jail doors opening and this wonderfully beautiful woman entering into his cell, what the thoughts of St. George must have been at the time. He understood this woman not on a sexual level, as the emperor would have desired, but on a personal level. By the time the night was over and the morning came, it was indeed this woman at the feet of St. George, asking him to baptize her and to make her a Christian. And of course, this infuriated the emperor. He began severe tortures on George. He tied him to a wheel with spokes and with razors to tear apart the flesh. George endured. He had him put in lime and added water to the lime to activate this acid type of effect. It didn't affect George.
One other ploy that the emperor tried on the suggestion of one of his officials was poison, the use of poison. And what St. George did, and that many Christians did and still do, particularly in monasteries, before eating and even before drinking, to make the sign of the cross. And so before St. George drank from this goblet, he did the sign of the cross and drank the poison, which did not harm him because he was protected by the sign of the precious cross. Well, then what was decided was that he'd be given another goblet with poison. But this time, so that St. George could not make the sign of the cross, they had his hands bound behind him, which was rather clever on the part of Diocletian and St. George's tormentors. But St. George was also very clever, having the wisdom of Christ. And so what he did was, when he was presented with the goblet and unable to make the sign of the cross with his hands, he simply asked him, where should he, from which part of the goblet should he drink? From here, 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 or here? And so with his head, he made the sign of the cross, drank the poison, and again was protected. Diocletian now shifted to challenging the saint. And he said, well, if this God of yours is really God, then command a person whom I know that is dead to rise from the dead. Resurrect a dead person that I know. And St. George said, sure. And indeed, he was presented with this dead person, this corpse, and indeed, through the power of Christ, St. George was able to resurrect the man from the dead. Interesting enough, after he had done that, Diocletian had the poor dead man, who had been just risen from the dead, martyred. He had him killed. Towards the end of St. George's life, St. George, knowing that the end is near, and that he has had this struggle for about 7 years, as some sources say, St. George now decides to present a challenge, so to speak, to Diocletian and his officials. And St. George says to Diocletian, tomorrow you will see the power of your gods in your temple. Of course, Diocletian and all the others assume that, well, St. George has come to his senses, so to speak. He's going to recant his faith in Christ and become a pagan and offer due worship to the idols in the temple.
He asked him to have an assembly in the temple, in the palace, bringing together him and all the people that the emperor had trusted and that the emperor had leading all of his armies and all of his empire.
So the next day comes, and St. George begins to pray. But he doesn't pray to the pagan gods, he prays to the Lord our God. At which point, the statues, the idols of the pagan gods, crumble, and the temple itself crumbles, thereby showing, of course, the power of the true God and the fact that these pagan gods have no power whatsoever. That's the last straw for Diocletian, and Diocletian has St. George beheaded. And that, again, was around 303 A.D., and St. George was about 23 years old. After that, friends of his then took his body and brought it to Palestine, and he was buried in the home of his mother, and that church is still there.
St. George reminds me of so many of the young, so many young men that I've known in my life, including comrades in arms in war. I happen to be a veteran of the war in Vietnam, and when I recall the average age of American soldiers in Vietnam was 19. That's about the age that St. George was when he came under terrible persecution. I've always associated him very directly with the tens and thousands and millions of young men who die in war. And so it's a very direct personal relationship that I feel for St. George.
I had the occasion, two times actually, to go to the Holy Land. And the first time that I went was in 1995. And of course, we went to the church there, the monastery that's there. And as we were going to the church, this is the first time I'd been there, I noticed some Muslim women, I knew they were Muslim from their dress, that as they came by the church, turned and bowed down towards the church, and then proceeded on their merry way. And I asked our guide there, why they did that. It seemed to be a sign of respect, veneration to St. George. And the guide said, indeed, that not only do Orthodox Christians honor St. George, but there is even some honor amongst Muslims. And in the past, when there was strife between Muslims and Christians, that the churches that the Muslims would not attack or even enter were the churches of St. George. They honor him because he was such a brave, courageous, and steadfast warrior. And in the Muslim world, Muslims, up until actually recently, were a nomadic peoples. And many Muslims in the old world live a nomadic life. And so that's a very hard life. You need to be a strong individual with much dedication and commitment and courage. And they admired and honored St. George.
When I was a young priest in my early priesthood, I had met an individual who was a devout Orthodox Christian, and he was leaving on a journey. He did not tell me where he was going, and so I pulled out of my wallet a paper icon of St. George, and he took the icon with him. And a few years later, he came to church one Sunday, and he hands me the icon. And I look at the icon, and I say, what has happened to it? Because the icon was all worn down. You could barely even see the saint. And he said, I had that in prison with me when I was a captive in Iran. What happened was he ended up becoming one of the hostages in Iran when Khomeini had taken some American prisoners. And they stripped them all down and took everything from them. And he had this icon on him. And it was taken from him by the guard. And later in the evening, the guard returned and handed him back the icon and allowed him to keep the icon. And during his whole time there in imprisonment, he said that he felt that St. George was always with him, that he felt his presence, and that he knew that eventually he would be returned safely to his home. And he says, turn the icon over. And I turned the icon over, and it said, St. George, protector of captives.